The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode of the America First podcast with me, Sebastian Gorka, is brought to you by Franklin Armory. Shop freedom, quality, and innovation at franklinarmory.com. Franklin Armory, we are facilitators of freedom.
This state is governed by the interests of the people of the state of Florida. It is not based on the demands of California corporate executives. They do not run this state. They do not control this state. I also thought it was interesting. I talked to the Speaker of the House yesterday afternoon, and he said Disney never called him while they were putting this through the House. They didn't seem to have a problem with it when it was going through. If this was such an affront, why weren't they speaking up at the outset? And yet they won't. And then for them to say they're going to actively work to repeal substantive protections for parents as a company that is supposedly marketing its services to parents with young children, I think they crossed the line. And, you know, people ask me, you know, kind of about, you know, their posture on the bill. I said, you know what? If we would have put in the bill that you were not allowed to have curriculum that discussed the oppression of the Uyghurs in China, Disney would have endorsed that in a second.
That's hitting them where it hurts. That is the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, taking on wokeism across American corporate environments in all states, Disney being one of the biggest. Our special guest for America First One-on-One has focused on that wokeism, but now he's broadening the aperture from Woke Inc. to Nation of Victims. We are very, very, very delighted to have him with us on the show today. Vivek Ramaswamy, welcome to the Salem Radio Network.
Good to be on, as always.
So you're a hard man to keep up with. I thought, you know, Woke Inc. was published yesterday, but clearly it's time to go on to the next mission. Let's just start with, for those who aren't familiar with your story, you have a very, very short bio on Twitter. All it says is capitalist and citizen. Tell us your story. Tell us where your family hails from and why you wrote the book and what else you do during the day.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So, you know, the capitalist and citizen, that captures the most important parts. But I'll rewind the clock. My parents came to this country in the late 70s and early 80s, my mom and dad, respectively. They came to Southwest Ohio, where I was born. They came from Kerala in southern India. Yeah. So they're both Indian immigrants. And yeah, actually, it's a funny story about that. My dad, I would frequently ask him, why'd you come halfway around the world to Cincinnati, Ohio? And he said that his older sister was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and that was the closest place he could find a job at the GE plant in Evendale, Ohio. That, of course, begged the question of why his older sister came halfway around the world to Fort Wayne, Indiana. And our family joke is it is the only U.S. state with the word India contained in the name of the state. So that's the family story and the joke of how we ended up in the Midwest. Grew up there, went to Harvard for college, thought I was going to be a scientist, graduated in 2007. Then I got into the world of biotech investing. That was interesting. On the eve of the 2008 financial crisis, getting a job at a prominent hedge fund in New York City, pretty interesting. Shaped a lot of my views of capitalism in ways that even affected my books. But anyway, from 2007 to 2014, I did that in New York. I was a partner at a hedge fund. I managed a biotech portfolio. Three of those years I spent at the same time in law school. I went to Yale for law school from 2010 to 2013, kept my job at the hedge fund as well. When I came back to New York City after law school, I just had my hedge fund job. And so I took the extra time for a 6-month stint in stand-up comedy. That did not go well.
Hang on. What did you just say? You did stand up?
I haven't told a lot of people this story. Yeah, I did 6 months of stand-up comedy in New York City.
Why? What made you do that? It's not a natural progression. Harvard, Yale, biotech, and stand-up. How the heck did that happen?
You know, I used to go to shows a lot, actually. So I used to go to this place called the Comedy Cellar. I liked it. you know, at a certain point, you watch people do it enough. You're like, you know, I think I could do that. I want to give that a try. That was a bad idea. Yeah, it didn't go super well. I did about 10 shows. I did probably the most prominent places I did something were I did the Broadway Comedy Club. I did Gotham Comedy Club. The people who loved me most had a talk with me and said, Vivek, this isn't going to work out as your next career. I wasn't imagining it would be the next career anyway, but I thought I was having some fun. But the audience and the people spoke, and they decided that it'd be better served
in the business. The market spoke, right?
The market. Yeah, the market spoke, and they said, you know, stick to the other part of the market that you're focused on.
That you must have been. Have you been on my buddy's, the Trigonometry podcast in the UK?
No. Oh, you know what? I want to say, actually, last year I was on that podcast. It's funny you mention it. Yeah.
Did you tell them that you're, because they're both stand-up comedians. Did you tell them this story?
I don't think I did. No, they're pretty funny. Actually, I did remember that show. It was kind of fun, but I haven't told this story during the podcast.
All right, as soon as we're done, I'm going to text them and tell them, guys, you got a fellow stand-up comedian. All right, and then what happened? So you realized that your market was elsewhere. What happened next?
Well, then I realized I had too much spare time on my hands, so I need to really figure out what I need to do. So actually, the funny version of the story is one of the things that I picked up from my hobby in stand-up comedy, and it's sitting right there, is a notebook that you carry everywhere you go. So that was one of the things that I learned.
Because you're writing down jokes, right?
Of course. And you're not even writing down jokes. You're just writing down experiences of things that annoy you or things that stick out to you. And then you go home and you think about if there's a joke in there. So that habit stuck. I actually ended up carrying it around with me as well in my day job as a biotech investor. But I jotted down all the things that were annoying me about the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, it is one of the most bureaucratic, government-regulated industries. We could go hours about that. But the funny thing is, kind of stand-up comedy led me to my career as an entrepreneur. I wrote down all the things that annoyed me about pharma, and it turned out that was my business plan for actually starting the company that I did. So I left my job.
2014, I started this biotech company that was designed to address these inefficiencies in pharma. Built that company for 7 years, led it as CEO. I will tell you, building something from scratch, it is humbling, but it was rewarding as well.
How old were you when you built that?
Let's see, I was probably 28, I want to say, when I started it, 28, 29, somewhere in there.
Wow.
Let's see, 2015, it was 2014 when I started the company, right? So what am I? I'm 37 now, 8 years ago. Yeah, 29 years old, let's call it.
Uh-huh.
So started the company, you know, ended up having some drugs that didn't work. That's drug development, but ended up having some that did too. And so five of those are FDA-approved products today that we worked on. I'm incredibly proud of that. Led the company as CEO. It's a multi-billion-dollar company today. But I stepped down in January of 2021 to work on a different kind of cancer. One of the drugs that I had the privilege of working on is now an approved drug for prostate cancer today, one of several of the drugs that I had a chance to work on during those years. However, I actually grew concerned that this biological cancer, while important, was something that other people could address. There was a new cultural cancer in corporate America that I was uniquely positioned to see. It landed even on the doorstep of my company and my experiences as an elite investor and CEO of a prominent biotech company that involved pushing one-sided political agendas through corporate America that I grew worried was not only going to threaten the integrity of American capitalism, but that it was also going to threaten the integrity of American democracy, because it said that rather than settling these political questions through free speech and open debate in the public square, where every citizen's voice and vote counts equally, we had to settle those questions through elite corporate boardrooms instead, taking direction from large money managers like Larry Fink at BlackRock. To me, that was a betrayal of what American democracy was supposed to be about. It was a betrayal of the vision that set this country into motion, a system of self-governance over a monarchical system in Europe. And I was deeply personally worried about it. So I couldn't address that while keeping my seat as a biotech CEO without having an adverse impact on the business, at least. Actually, there were a couple advisors to my company that resigned after I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. That was a wake-up call to me to say that, you know what, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to speak as a citizen rather than, for the time being then, as a capitalist. So I stepped down as CEO. I remained on the board, but I stepped down as CEO, decided to write Woke Inc., did it without any agenda, which I loved, just wrote the book going deeply into my own personal thoughts on these issues that, you know, I didn't think of it as a conservative book. I think that liberals could effectively, principled liberals certainly find the same resonance as conservatives would with the message that said we need to separate politics from business. That was the heart of Woke Inc. But, you know, there were some questions that by the end of writing the book and by the time of my book tour and questions that I got, questions that were unaddressed, questions of, yes, even if corporations were cynically using these political agendas to aggregate greater profit and greater power, why is it that the citizenry is still falling for it? Why is the general population falling for it?
So that's
that was a question I didn't answer in Woke Inc., and that led to the latest book that I just put out this week.
All right. So to be explicit, he went from battling cancer in the biotech, biological cancer, to battling the cancer of wokeism. The first book was Woke Inc. We had you on the show, I don't know, over a year ago when it came out, Inside Corporate America's Social Justice Scam. But some questions were left unanswered, and that's why we have available today. Order it right now, Nation of Victims. We're talking to Vivek Ramaswamy. I'm Sebastian Gorka. If you enjoy the show, guarantee that you never ever miss a millisecond. Subscribe today. Go to Spotify, plug in my name, Sebastian Gorka, America First. Give us a 5-star review. It does matter with the dastardly algorithms. Share the links because we have to win this fight. We have to beat this cancer. So, Vivek, I got to ask the question. How does somebody who goes to Harvard and Yale and then works in, you know, venture capital and biotech, why aren't you woke? I'm going to ask the why aren't you a champion of wokeism?
You know, it's an interesting question. I can't give you my own personal journey for why I arrived at my views. I only know that I believe what I do. I will tell you that, you know, so there's a journalist that's interviewing me now for some big profile that are going to do in the next month. And here was a diagnosis that she gave me, which I thought was kind of interesting. Nobody had put it to me this way. I hadn't thought this way. So we'll see what she comes out with in her piece. But, you know, it's actually from a left leaning outlet. And so we'll see how those pieces turn out. But, you know, the interesting question that I got was, she's like, look, have you ever experienced racism growing up? And I said, yeah, I have. You know, I grew up in Southwest Ohio as an Indian American kid with a funny name and parents with speaking with an accent. It was a little different. But when I think about the kind of racism I experienced, did it come some from white kids I grew up with? At times. But, you know, I went to a relatively, you know, not well-to-do public school as well. But if I had to pick, much of the racism I've experienced actually has come from non-white students, non-white peers.
Oh, Vivek, you're not allowed to say that.
I'm just telling you about my experience.
Are you saying that people who aren't white can be racist too? Oh my gosh! No, of course, I'm just joking. It was so.
I mean, it's my
anybody.
Experience, right?
Right. Hang on. Let's use the right terminology. It is Vivek Ramaswamy's lived experience. Am I doing that right?
Lived experience. You can't argue with it, right? That's the point of using a lived experience, as opposed to the other kinds of experiences.
Right, dead experiences or zombie experiences,
the
whatever.
Dead experience,
right.
Lived experience. This is one of my lived experiences, not my dead experiences. Thankfully, I haven't had too many of those yet. But the interesting thing was that was a 360-degree experience that taught me that, you know what? There's a lot of injustice that runs in a lot of directions. Racism or injustice or oppression, it's not unidirectional. It's complicated. It runs in a lot of different directions. And I think the right way out of it is to stop searching for those invisible lines of oppression rather than reviving the idea that we're individual agents who at the end of the day are authors of our own destiny. Yeah, so I was in middle school. This was in about eighth grade. And, you know, I was a studious guy, scrawny Indian kid running from class to class, carrying my science textbooks. And there was a kid who pushed me down a flight of stairs. Why? It's just what you did to an overachiever. It was a punishment for an overachiever in school. Now, as I said, I didn't go to the richest of public schools through eighth grade. It was actually filled with kids who had been held back by a grade or two grades or sometimes three grades. This kid happened to be black. But anyway, for me, the eye-opening feature was that people can behave in barbaric ways, even in racist ways, regardless of the color of their own skin. Had we experienced it, you know, some sorts of, you know, condescension amongst, you know, certain white families or people who came from economically more privileged backgrounds or people who didn't talk with a funny accent or their parents didn't talk with a funny accent. Sure, that was part of it. But it came from people who were black, white, brown in every different given direction. And if I look back, am I sure that I was the noble kid that behaved every way that I was supposed to have growing up? I probably didn't. But it laid out for me the fact that it's about human beings and the mistakes we make with respect to one another and the way we treat one another as individuals that matters more
than one unidimensional narrative of systemic racism that runs only in one direction.
So
I reject that narrative.
This is the question I wanted to ask you next. If somebody said to you, if a foreigner said to you who's visiting or whatever, isn't America a systemically racist nation? What would you say to them?
I would say no. I would say that at the end of the day, first of all, the word systemically racist is purposefully created to evade definition. I know what it means to be a racist. It means to judge someone on the basis of the color of their skin rather than on the content of their character or their beliefs. To think that you can look at their skin color and know something about their character or their beliefs, that is racism. Today, that's anti-racism. That's called anti-racism. But to me, that's what racism is. What does systemic racism mean? How can a system itself be racist if racism itself is about the invidious judgment that an individual human being makes about another? So the first thing I would say is your question is ill-formulated because systemic racism is purposefully vague. It's kind of like when you put social in front of justice. I know what justice is.
Right.
It is reaching the right outcome and the just outcome in a case of a dispute between two individuals or agents in the world. But what does social justice mean? It tries to generalize the concept of justice in a way that betrays the idea of justice itself. So that'd be my first response. But my second response would be, you know what, even if systemic racism did exist, America was the best last hope in human history for being able to create a meritocratic society, a free society, where people were able to achieve whatever they wanted, regardless of the color of their skin or where their parents came from or what their accent was. America was the country that they were able to achieve their dreams without inhibition through a system of meritocracy in this country. Were we always perfect? No, we weren't. But I would rather live in a nation that was hypocritical in living up to its ideals than in a nation that did not have those ideals at all. In a certain way, having ideals is what made our hypocrisy possible. But America itself was born on an idea. It's not even a geographic place. It was born on an idea that brought together a divided group of people 250 years ago around the common idea that you are free to do what you want as an agent in this world, regardless of where you came from, and with your own hard work and commitment and dedication, you can realize the American dream for yourself. Those are the ideas that this country was built on, that our national culture is built on. And so to call that a systemically racist nation is to reject, I think, the last best hope for the free world as we know it.
I want to ask you, how hard was it to make that decision to go from just keeping your head down, being a businessman, being an investor, an entrepreneur, to being a political actor, if you will, being an author and championing those values openly? I mean, you said a couple of your board members resigned. How tough a decision was that for you personally to take this public, outward-facing stance?
Yeah, I mean, it was a couple of advisors to the company that I mentioned. Let me be really honest about it. I mean, I think it was not easy. But I don't want to paint some story of hardship that I uniquely faced. In a lot of ways, it was easier for me to do than a lot of other ordinary, everyday Americans. I didn't have to worry about putting food on the dinner table. Let's start with that, all right? I had achieved enough success by that point in time that I knew I was not going to have to worry probably in my lifetime, and my kids wouldn't have to worry in their lifetime either about putting food on the dinner table. Well, you know what a lot of other Americans face right now is a choice. Between putting food on the dinner table and speaking freely, between the American dream and the First Amendment, I had already lived the full arc of the American dream, right? I was in my early 30s, founded a multi-billion-dollar company. For me, that made things very pragmatically a lot easier. So were there some practical ways in which it was difficult for me? Did it feel difficult? Did I want to pat myself on the back every day telling myself how brave I was? Probably a little bit. It's human nature to want to sort of compliment oneself. But as I've sort of traveled the country over the last year, it was easy by comparison for me to do relative to a lot of people who didn't have the luxuries that I did to be able to do the same thing. That's frankly what gave me even a greater sense of obligation and purpose to do it. And that if it was going to be hard for me to do, I can only imagine how hard it would be for someone else without the same good fortune to be able to do the same thing.
He would not make a good liberal or a Democrat because he doesn't want to be a victim. He eschews being a victim. The book is Nation of Victims. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First. If you enjoy the show, please support those who make it possible. Great Americans like Mike Lindell. You heard what the FBI did to him last week. Go to MyPillow.com, buy whatever you want. Get up to 66% off if you use my name. They've canceled him. They banned him at Walmart. Let's show Mike that we've got his back. Call 800-829-8468, or just go to MyPillow.com. That's MyPillow.com, promo code G-O-R-K-A. MyPillow is having their biggest sheet sale of the year. You all have helped build MyPillow into the amazing company that it is today. Now, Mike Lindell, my buddy, the inventor and CEO, wants to give back to my listeners. The Percal bed sheet set is available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they're on sale. For example, the queen size is regularly $89.98, but now for you, just $39.98 with your listener promo. Order now, because when they're gone, they're gone. The Percal sheets are breathable and have a cool, crisp feel. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Don't miss out on this incredible offer. It's a limited supply, so be sure to order now. Call 1-800-829-8468, promo code Gorka, or just go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square, and plug in G-O-R-K-A. That's 1-800-829-8468 or MyPillow.com, code Gorka. Dear friends, you know that here at America First, we are 110% behind our veterans, and that's why we are honored. We are delighted to support an amazing organization, Mighty Oaks. Their motto is never fight alone. Their program has assisted thousands of veterans who are suffering from post-traumatic stress and their families. We are dedicating this month to their incredible mission. Please support them by going to my webpage, that's SebGorka.com. Make a donation, everything. There are no costs to the veterans for the support they receive from this organization. If you've wondered how you can give back, then this is one of the easiest ways. The website is SebGorka.com. The banner is Restore Our Warriors. That's S-E-B-G-O-R-K-A. And at the very top, just the banner, Restore Our Warriors. God bless every single one of you who is helping our veterans. Remember, there are more than 20 veterans every single day who take their lives. This organization has helped hundreds to not take that decision. First, before I walk through some of the chapters of your book, Vivek, can you just give us a snapshot? You are the doctor. You are the specialist right now. You're looking at the corpus that is corporate America. Give us a diagnosis. How rampant is the virus of politics that undermines meritocracy in the C-suites of America today?
So if you asked me even a year ago, I would tell you that it was rampant and it was killing the host. However, I'm a little bit more optimistic now relative to then. And I'm not going to take the credit, whatever. I've been focused on this over the last year with the book, and I think it's had some influence. But I think there's just cultural tides that have begun to change, some of which have been introduced by economic hardship itself. So the Federal Reserve is now tightening monetary policy instead of raining money from on high like manna from heaven. That's created a different economic environment in the country, where much of the wokeism that you saw in corporate America was really just a feature of excess when times were so good, fueled by Federal Reserve policy, fueled by government throwing money into the system. Now, as those times begin to get harder, those excesses aren't so easy to afford anymore. So a good example is Netflix. Even earlier this year, after they had a disastrous quarterly earnings report, after they reported subscriber declines and revenue declines and profitability declines, then they put the word excellence at the top of their cultural document, and they tell their employees, you know what? If you're going to, you know, not want to work on a project because it offends you, if it has artistic merit, we're still going to keep doing it. And you know what? You could show yourself the door and close the door on your way out. That is pretty remarkable as a 180 for a company in the heart of Hollywood. But what was the prompt for getting them there? You know, look, I think that some of us who have been changing the intellectual environment with the books we've writing, you know, we might change the conditions a little bit. But the real winner here was the economic lever that said that, you know what, they're losing customers. They're losing subscribers. They need to get their act together. As we now see economic hardship hit other segments of the economy, I think that's actually going to be a tailwind to drive change, to get companies to start saying, you know what, actually, we may need to focus on our productivity again. And you know what? If we're going to hire engineers based on diversity, equity, and inclusion-driven racial quota systems rather than how effective they are as engineers, we might not be as competitive, which means we might have a serious problem. We might have an existential risk. So I'm not yet an optimist on this, or I'm not yet in a position to say we need to be optimistic about this happening automatically. But even relative to a year ago, at least there's a good basis for at least thinking that the tides are turning. And I think that with more of us on the front lines pushing this ball forward, I'm more optimistic about the change we can have if we keep our foot on the gas.
Is there a danger, Vivek, of a bifurcation of the economy when, you know, some corporations understand, but then there is a state-driven political matrix being pushed down on them? When California says you've got to have X number of women, X number of minorities in your actual C-suite boards, then there are going to be companies that are stuck in this political miasma, and others who say, okay, I'm moving to Florida or Texas. Is that a danger, a bifurcation of the economy?
A lot of this is state-driven, though, Seb. You put your finger on the right pulse. You know, I'm giving a colloquial version of what happens here, but let's take in the energy sector and certain other sectors. Europe adopts some disastrous policy in the name of fighting climate change. Okay, that's step one. Step two is California copies Europe, and both the citizens of California and those of Europe live second world conditions as a consequence.
Right.
But that's not enough. They then say, okay, they want the rest of the country to live that way too. And so they use the CalPERS pension fund or the sovereign wealth fund of Norway or other European financial institutions that say they won't invest in other asset managers or in other financial institutions unless those other institutions in the private sector adopt those same criteria. And that's how it gets permeated and gets multiplied. Throughout the rest of the country as well, even though the rest of the country didn't ever voted for those policies, even because the rest of the country didn't even know those policies were being implemented through the private sector using their money to do it, because California held the keys to tell BlackRock to say that BlackRock has to adopt these commitments or else CalPERS isn't going to give them money, that BlackRock then takes everyone else for a ride from states ranging from, you know, Ohio to West Virginia to Indiana to Illinois to Missouri to Texas, for that matter, until some of these more recent changes. Large asset managers like BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard have taken everyone else along for the ride that California and New York put them on.
We're talking to Vivek Ramaswamy. Follow him at Vivek G. Ramaswamy on Twitter. The book is Nation of Victims. Order it now. You are listening to America First One-on-One, coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studios. If you're in daily pain, if you've tried everything else and failed to find relief, try this 100% drug-free product that is liberating 500,000 Americans across the nation right now, me included. Yes, I had a lower back pain issue that plagued me for 9 years, almost a decade. I took Relief Factor 2 weeks later. I was pain-free, and I'm still pain-free more than 3.5 years later. There's only one way to find out. Order the 3-week quick starter pack at relieffactor.com. Do it today. What have you got to lose except for the pain? Call 800-500-8384 or go to relieffactor.com. You deserve to know the number, 800-500-8384, relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com. You've mentioned one entity multiple times in our interview already, and for most people out there who don't live in the rarefied atmosphere that you do or who haven't worked in Wall Street, they won't be familiar with it. What is BlackRock? Can you tell our 3 million listeners what is BlackRock, and why is it acting in very irresponsible or dangerous ways?
Sure. So BlackRock is arguably the world's largest financial institution in the private sector. It's the world's largest asset manager. It manages nearly $10 trillion and allocates that by investing in companies, in publicly traded companies. And they're using the money of everyday citizens, probably the money of many, if not most of the listeners of this program, to buy shares in corporate America, in publicly traded U.S. companies. So far, so good. Well, the problem is that in recent years, BlackRock, and they're the biggest, but there's other firms just like them, including Vanguard and State Street and Invesco. I could go on, but BlackRock's the biggest of them. What they're doing is they're using the money of everyday citizens to tell corporate America to adopt social and political agendas that most of those everyday citizens actually disagree with. That is a fiduciary breach. I believe that is a breach of trust. You know, I can give you a couple examples.
Before you give us the examples, why is it a fiduciary breach? Is it because they are acting in a political way, which is not their mandate? Could you give us just, you know, the correct description of why they're not supposed to do that?
Sure. So if you're managing someone else's money, you have an obligation to look after their sole best interest without any other mixed motivation. Yeah. Under state fiduciary law, under ERISA laws, which are the laws that govern how retirement accounts can be invested, you have to look at the capital owner's sole interest. What I see happening in the landscape, you know, Larry Fink a few years ago said that businesses have to earn their social license to operate. These are the kinds of things he said. Now, what are they doing? Let's look at the facts. BlackRock earlier this year voted in favor of a racial equity audit proposal at Apple, the world's largest company by market capitalization. Apple's board recommended against this proposal. BlackRock, a large shareholder, still voted in favor of it. And indeed, the proposal carried majority shareholders' support. Now, Apple can't say anything in response to that because that's the shareholders of Apple saying that this is what we, the shareholders, want to see. But here's the problem. BlackRock claims to be the shareholders, but the real shareholders are the everyday citizens whose money they are investing in Apple or in Chevron, where they voted for a Scope 3 emissions proposal that was proposed to fight climate change. Why is it in the best interest of Chevron as a business to adopt a Scope 3 emissions cap? The correct answer is it's not. That's why the board of Chevron recommended against it. Yet even still, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard in 2021 all voted in favor of it. I consider that a breach of fiduciary duty. And as a side note, Seb, you may have seen this. I sent a public letter, shareholder letter, to the board of Chevron just last week calling this out and asking for greater accountability by providing a different shareholder voice that told Chevron, you know what? You should do whatever allows you to be most financially successful without apologizing for it, even if that means drilling for more oil, because that's what a company should do. Yeah. And whatever your views are on climate change, we should sort that out through the political process without BlackRock deciding what the answer to that question is in our corporate boardrooms.
So here's I'm going to jump right in to the end point, you know, the winning the war question. I got lots of more questions and we'll get to them. Relax, guys. Who fixes this? Because if you know, fake shareholders, the Potemkin shareholders who aren't really the shareholders, can get a corporation to bend at the knee at the altar of wokeism, who the hell is going to fix this? God bless you for writing your books, coming on my show, going on, you know, Fox and Newsmax and everything else. But at the end of the day, are we just beholden to, I don't know, another Ron DeSantis or President Trump coming back? And as conservatives who believe in free markets, do we want more regulation or do we just wait like Rip Van Winkle for the real shareholders to get their crap together? I mean, who's going to fix this?
I would say the latter approach is far more promising than state action because this is a problem in the markets and in the culture. Right. Let's fix it through the market. So, Seb, I'm with you. Writing books and talking on cable, I've been doing that for a year and a half, for 2 years. That's great. That's all well and good. I said, you know what? We need to fix the problem. So earlier this year, I started Strive. Strive is competing directly against BlackRock.
So this is an asset management company. You've created it, Strive Asset Management. So what's different about Strive? Let's give a case study.
Yeah, so case study is we tell companies using shareholder power to tell them to focus exclusively on excellence, on delivering excellent products and services to their customers and making money without apologizing for it, rather than advancing someone else's social or political agendas. So I'll give you just for a case study. Well, Strive launched its first index fund last month, in the month of August. It's an index fund of the U.S. energy companies. It's the U.S. Energy Index Fund. Its ticker is DRILL, D-R-L-L, DRILL, with a very simple message, as you might have guessed from the name. It tells American, Strive tells American energy companies to drill, to frack, to do whatever allows them to be most successful without regard to any political or cultural agenda, period. Financially measurable return on investment, that's what a U.S. energy company should care about, not announcing its support for the Paris Climate Accords or its support for a carbon tax, as Chevron has done over the last year after these shareholders pressured them into bending the knee. The funny thing about this is within the first month, DRLL, Drill, raised over $300 million.
Wow.
I was able to send a letter to the board of Chevron, bringing a different shareholder voice to the table. I've engaged on behalf of Strive engaged with over 10 U.S. energy companies already. But I hope, Sebastian, this is just the beginning of a broader movement in capital markets. And I am personally much more optimistic about driving change this way than through the political process. If I cared about the political process, I would run for office in politics. I think this is actually how we drive change.
All right. Well, I'm going to talk to my financial advisor as soon as I'm off the show, and I'm going to have him check all of this out. And I'm just blows my mind. that nobody had the ticker name drill yet, and you're the guys. It's like when I came to DC and I had my Mustang registered, I said, okay, I want a really cool license plate, and nobody had registered Art of War. So my license plate, how can I be in DC and nobody thought of Art of War as a license plate? I'm very impressed with your approach to all of this. So God bless. We're talking to Vivek Ramaswamy. The book is Nation of Victims. Order it right now. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First, coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studios. Relief Factor, pain relief that works, pain relief that's real, pain relief that's liberating. 500,000 Americans right now, me included. But it's not just me. It's people like Yvonne from California. This is her story. Both my husband and I are in our 70s and are so grateful to have found Relief Factor. We tried so many other things, so many other solutions, but none of them have given us the freedom of being pain-free like Relief Factor. Just those two words, pain-free, should be reason enough for you to order the 3-week quick starter pack at ReliefFactor.com. It'll be at your door in 3 days or less. Take it morning and evening like I do. And I promise you, Dr. G's guarantee, by the end of those 3 weeks, you will know whether it works for you like it works for me, Yvonne, and 500,000 of your fellow Americans. Call today, 800-500-8384, or just go to ReliefFactor.com. That's 800-500-8384, ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Here's a question for you. If we're going to engender an anti-pandemic, a new virus of excellence, this is for me why, you know, people missed what Top Gun Maverick was about. I sat there and I loved it. I saw the original one when it came out. And I'm in the movie. I'm about an hour in. And suddenly this thing came to me, Vivek. I said, this is great, but not because it's rah-rah America, not because it's Tom Cruise and G-Forces, because everything about this film is a celebration of America and a very specific aspect of America, which is excellence. That movie was the celebration of bloody excellent performance. That's what it was. These people were the best of the best, irrespective of their skin color. My pushback. Can we celebrate, can we engender, can we propagate a culture of excellence or return to the one that we had that built this nation in an age where social media is not controlled by those who believe in excellence? There is no opportunity for, you know, forgiving people on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. So how much of a stumbling block or an obstacle is a clearly woke, politically active social media Palo Alto class? Have you thought about that?
I have, and it's a big obstacle. I do not believe it is yet insurmountable, though. Here's why I hold out some hope. Is the answer isn't going to run through social media or the digital world. The answer is going to run through the offline world. And I think that this is where the everyday citizen can play a role in the offline world of reviving the civic fortitude, the psychic fortitude that comes from the everyday real experiences we have in the offline world. When people complained about Facebook or Instagram not doing enough for teen girls who worried about body image issues, they expected me to criticize Facebook for that too. You know what I said? No, I'm not going to criticize Facebook for that because I don't want Facebook being even responsible for managing the psychic state of teen girls or the cultivation of virtue in a society. Mark Zuckerberg is not a priest. He is not a rabbi. We don't want him to be our priest or our rabbi or Jack Dorsey either. We need to recreate the kind of institutions, religious institutions, family, civic institutions in our private sector that give us so much self-confidence, both as individuals and as a people, that we're not vulnerable to the exploitation of algorithms that have a knack for sussing out human insecurities. That's what this whole social media empire is built on, identifying human frailties and picking at them algorithmically in a way to gain a greater window into our soul than we have into our own. Maybe the right answer is actually to gain that greater window into our own soul that doesn't leave us vulnerable to being picked at by the algorithms of modern social media, which is also why I worry about the metaverse, because the whole premise of the metaverse is dissolving the boundaries between the online and the offline world.
Yeah.
I think we need to be really careful about that because it's going to be our path in the offline world that ultimately gets us to our restored path back to excellence. and our path back to a shared American identity.
Yeah, you can't have excellence in a world that is artificial and doesn't exist. I would make one modification. It's not the offline world. It's the real world. That's where we have to engender meritocracy. All right, I'm going to stop it now. I'm out of time. Absolutely superb. Follow this man on Twitter. Order the book right now, A Nation of Victims, so we can stop being a nation of victims. I'm Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to President Trump. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, keep your head on a swivel. Watch your six. Hold the line. Never give up. Never give in. And stay frosty.
Our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
The world will little note or long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here.
I have a dream. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people...
This is America First with Sebastian Gorka.
It's great to be back. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First. I've been in studio filming a TV show for the last 4 days. Yes, Saturday, Sunday. Sorry, I was working on Sunday. And Monday and Tuesday. But we had superb fill-in guest hosts. Thank you, Grant Stinchfield, and thank you, Uncle Jimbo, Jim Hansen, for stepping into the breach. But it's good to be back, especially... Oh, my gosh. Who is the dumbest person on social media? In the media! Maybe in America? His name is rather citrusy. He is on CNN. His last name is Lemon, and you know how the British can just destroy you without breaking a sweat? Here's a historian who taught Don Lemon a lesson, and we're going to open the show with it. Play cut!
And then you have those who are asking for reparations for colonialism, and they're wondering, you know, $100 billion, $24 billion here and there, $500 million there. Some people want to be paid back, and members of the public are wondering, why are we suffering when you are, you know, you have all of this vast wealth? Those are legitimate concerns.
Well, I think you're right about reparations in terms of if people want it, though, what they need to do is you always need to go back to the beginning of a supply chain. Where was the beginning of the supply chain? That was in Africa. And when that crossed the entire world, when slavery was taking place, which was the first nation in the world that abolished slavery? The first nation in the world to abolish it. It was started by William Wilberforce, was the British. In Great Britain, they abolished slavery. 2,000 naval men died on the high seas trying to stop slavery. Why? Because the African kings were rounding up their own people. They had them on cages waiting in the beaches. No one was running into Africa to get them. And I think you're totally right. If reparations need to be paid, we need to go right back to the beginning of that supply chain and say, who was rounding up their own people and having them handcuffed in cages? Absolutely. That's where they should start. And maybe, I don't know, the descendants of those families where they died in the high seas trying to stop the slavery, that those families should receive something too, I think, at the same time.
It's an interesting discussion, Hillary. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
What? Does he agree? Is he a white supremacist? Don Lemon, you're agreeing that it should be the African slave traders who sold their fellow black Africans to the West that should be paying reparations to the British naval officers and seamen who died stopping the slave traders? I have to ask Mr. G, maybe I missed something. Was that some kind of special editing? Was that a deep fake? How did Don Lemon not actually say something there?
Because he's never heard that before, and he had no idea how to respond.
But he's wearing those glasses that make him look so clever. Did they not work?
I don't know. Is he going to wear them in the morning, or is he going to get rid of those glasses when he moves?
Oh, hang on. I forgot. He's been quote-unquote promoted, hasn't he, from the prime time in the evening to nobody watches in the morning show even less.
And has to get up at 3 a.m. and do 3 hours a day.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a promotion. Thank you, guys. I might have to play that every single hour. I might have to play that every single segment. It's just too delicious. Yeah, Britain stopped the slave trade, fought to stop it. We had a war here in America where 600 Americans died as a result of stopping slavery. So who should get the reparations? Interesting. And who should be paying them? All right, dear friends, big news of the day. Let me put on my national security hat. For the first time since the cessation of hostilities in 1945, the Kremlin has reinstituted the draft. Yes, they will be drafting young men to be put into the meat grinder that is the war in Ukraine. And secondly, as that statement was made by Vladimir Putin, the former KGB colonel, we have him saying he is prepared to use whatever means necessary, including nuclear weapons. And he added, and I'm not bluffing. Little tip for you, old Vlad, my chum. When you have to add, and I'm not bluffing, it means you are bluffing. It's like when, you know, the old guy here in the White House says, no joke, it's a real story. You know he is lying. Now, this has been going the rounds for the last 12 hours like crazy. This is the big news of the day. Vlad's going to nuke us. Let's stop for a second. What's happened in the last 8 months in Ukraine? Let's begin with the classic Cold War phrase, balance of forces, the estimate of the situation, the sit rep, as we used to call it in the British Army, the situation report. Before Russia again invaded the Ukraine, because remember they did so under Obama's presidency when they took the Crimea. Yes, the Crimea belonged to the Ukraine and was taken by Vladimir Putin. Why? Because a pathetic stick insect of a man, a lanky chap from Illinois, was in the White House, and they said, okay, this should be easy. Let's take Crimea. Well, they did it again when his vice president became the commander-in-chief. And what happened? On the invasion of Ukraine 8 months ago, Russia, depending on which metrics you used, was ranked as second or third most powerful military force in the world, second only to us and perhaps China. On that same international ranking of defense capabilities, national security capacity, Ukraine was in the 21st, 22nd position, depending on which list you consulted. So if the guy who's second place goes up against the guy who's ranked 22nd, should be pretty quick, right? I mean, that's what that fat, useless oxygen thief Mark Milley said, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. You remember when he said, yeah, they'll probably be in Kiev in 3 days. Not so much. I guess there must be a lot of white rage in Kiev, eh, Mark? Because Ukraine has basically fought Russia to a standstill. The unclassified estimates, if you look at reports coming out of the UK and elsewhere, is in excess of 20 or 30,000 Russians killed in action. Which is stunning, because the war has lasted less than a year. And we're talking about the same rate of casualties for the 10 years of the Afghan invasion by the Soviet Union. How is that possible? I'll tell you how it's possible. Two things. Massive graft and corruption in Russia, with generals selling Russian national assets
and weapons and armaments to the highest bidder to pad out their bank accounts in Cyprus and in Switzerland. And secondly, going up against a nation such as the Ukraine, whose citizens were killed in mass numbers by the Kremlin in the 1920s and 30s. 8 million Ukrainians that we know of murdered, starved to death by Stalin in the Holodomor. Which means that nation, they're going to fight till the last 12-year-old that can carry an AK is killed. They will never give up. Now, I'm not saying that they're going to win overnight or it's a de facto foregone conclusion, because Russia is a meat grinder. We saw that in Stalingrad and elsewhere. But this is embarrassing. Mobilization? The draft? Very embarrassing for the Kremlin. I've said it before and I'll say it again. We don't have to fight for them and we shouldn't fight for them. But what is happening in Ukraine is their 1776. And if we hadn't been assisted in our war against the British by people like the French, you'd all be speaking real English like me. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First, coming to you live from the ReliefFactor.com studios. When it comes to our veterans, how do we support them? Imagine if you're an NCO, if you're an officer, if you're a specialist who's had multiple tours in theater in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and you come home maybe not physically wounded, but definitely psychologically scarred. You need help, and that's what the Mighty Oaks Foundation is doing to veterans reintegrating into our society. Here's James, one of the many, many... do we have the capacity to play this audio, Alex? Is our computer back online? All right, so let's listen to James, who tells us how blessed he was to receive counseling and peer-based discipleship from the Mighty Oaks Foundation.
I heard about Mighty Oaks to a good friend of mine, and this place really makes sure you don't have to worry about anything other than yourself and your relationship with God while you're here. Everything from the food to the people you're around. When I first heard of this place, I didn't know what to think.
Go and support them, sebgorka.com, the Mighty Oaks banner at the top. That's S-E-B-G-O-R-K-A, Mighty Oaks.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.